This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 o'clock this afternoon. This afternoon, we're going to devote the whole hour to a single book. I had in mind two books, but the other one didn't work out, and that's just as well because of the two, this is the more provocative and certainly will provide a great deal to talk about. It's a book called The Veil, Women Writers on Its History, Lore, and Politics, edited by Jennifer Heath, and published about a month ago by the University of California Press. It's maybe 20 essays. I'm not sure exactly. I think Jennifer's at the other end, and she can tell me exactly how many.
How many contributors?
Yeah.
Gosh, that's a good question. I think it's 21, including me.
Okay, I thought so. Anyway, almost every third page has something provocative to say. As you point out in your introduction, it is not all of one piece. The authors quite often contradict one another and have radically different opinions, which is one of the things that makes it so fascinating.
Thank you.
I think we'll start out with this simple question of what is a veil?
What is a veil? Well, a veil, you know, the word veil actually comes from the Latin, which is, you know, it starts sort of as a sail or a cloth, just a cloth. But then it moves into that which reveals or conceals or, you know, then words like revelatio come out of veil. It moves into shroud and to enshroud. It's also a verb as well as a noun. And like that.
Well,
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And when you say revelatio, that means to unveil. So a revelation is an unveiling.
Exactly.
I tried, before I actually started on your book, well, actually, I'd read, I think, about three of the essays, and then I realized that there was a slight discontinuity there because I, probably because I grew up in the 50s when women were wearing, Western American women at least, were wearing those little veils on their little hats. I always think of a veil as primarily a face covering, but it's really a head covering of all sorts.
Oh, it can be all sorts of things. It can also be, excuse me for interrupting you, it can also be underwear.
As in Mormon?
Well, not just the Mormons, but also there's a Zoroastrian form of undergarment that's worn as a sign of humility and there's also the Orthodox Jews, the Talit Katan, and the Zoroastrian one is called a Sudri Kushtri. And then there's a sacred shirt of the Sikhs. All that is veiling. I mean, veiling has so many different meanings, but more often than not, it has to do with a display of humility. Right.
Although when I started asking friends, after I had my disconnect by thinking of veils as a face, I started asking friends, and the first person I talked to thought of a veil as a decoration, like a bridal veil. And the very first author in your anthology points out that veils were in early historic Mesopotamia, in some of the first statuary we have from that area,
mm-hmm.
they were signs of status, that it was only upper-class women who could wear veils.
Well, exactly. And, you know, and for example, in Afghanistan many, many, many years ago now, country women didn't wear the burqa, what's also called in Afghanistan a chadri, didn't wear it, but wanted to. Because it was a sign of leisure, and, you know, I mean, you can't milk a goat in a burqa. But it's a sign of leisure and wealth, and, you know, so people wanted to. It's much more than it seems to be.
But it gets very complicated, because the author of one of the essays about Afghanistan said that just at the time that the rural women, or women in smaller towns, as they gained a little bit of leisure or status, they started wearing burqas, and the women in the cities were taking them off.
Yeah, because everybody's the one step ahead of the other,
right.
in some fashionable way, you know. But, you know, with the wedding veil, there's a piece in the book by Sarah Bell called Nubo. It's a narrative. There are two graphic narratives, and one is by Marjan Satrapi, who is the author of Persepolis, and the other is by Sarah Bell. And Sarah talks about the veil and describes how, you know, it's not merely decoration, but protection and all kinds of other things. And that many cultures, East and West, use a wedding veil because it's got a way deeper meaning than just something pretty you put on your head.
And she says that the verb nubo means I veil myself.
That's right.
And the whole idea of being nubile, of ready to be married, means you're ready to wear the veil.
Right, exactly.
Now, you actually divide your anthology into three sections, but then you almost immediately deny it because you say the first section is primarily the sacred and spiritual overtones. The second is more the sensual meanings of the veil as it applies to people's bodies. And the third is more the political. But you can't separate these three categories in any way.
Mm-mm. You really can't. So they overlap, and it's very hard. I mean, I would frankly not have made any sections in the book. But this is the new thing that's done in anthologies. And so there was I was asked to do so. And so as I began to look at it, I thought, well, you know, I could make it religious. I could divide it into religions, but then there'd be little leftover pieces, right? Sort of little appendices hanging there that aren't particularly religious. I mean, I could make it religions and then secular, but then there are all these kind of little extra religions that don't, that are, you know, I mean, a whole section on Zoroastrianism, what's that? You know, maybe it's more of a few paragraphs anymore. So also if you divide it into religion, then you have the Catholic readers going straight to the Catholic section and not really paying attention to, say, the rest. And that's not the idea of the book. The idea of the book is to try to put all this veiling stuff into some kind of universal context. So that's, and because, you know, there was this the idea that it really should have sections, I thought that it should be sensual, sacred, sociopolitical. But then I got really into trouble because all of it's mixed up.
And even in the very beginning, in, say, the Amish veil, where the author of that essay talks about going to an Amish community and noticing the slight differences in veiling between the generations and how much decoration you can add. And there will be long community meetings to decide if something is really permissible or not.
Oh, yeah.
And even though the idea is that you are being modest and essentially humble is humility is one of the Amish traits that they promote more than anything else. But it's but even something like a veil can quickly become a fashion item.
And oh God, yeah, oh yeah, I love it. In that chapter, my favorite part is the little girl who's in church and she's flirting with a boy by swinging the loose ribbons of her veil of her bonnet around.
Right.
No.
And then in the Middle Ages, the development of nuns' habits in the same way very quickly became, they stopped being very simple, rough robes or cowls, and the wimples that nuns would wear could get very, very elaborate and could have very fancy stitching and slight ornamentation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, and it's still, I mean, it used to be before 65, you could tell the various denominations of, you know, of women religious by what kind of, you know, the flying nun, kind mm-hmm. of, by what kind of wimples and headdresses they wore, as well as the habit itself. But yeah, it's of course it's fashion, and then in Iran, the book shows photos of and not nearly as many as there are. There's some gorgeous photos by that photographer, name my escapes me at the moment, but of fashion shows where the Iranians, the regime has the idea. They know that fashion is what's going to get people, so they're trying to persuade women, you know, in addition to the rather more brutal aspects of forced veiling, mandated veiling that happen in Iran. They're also, and the morality police on the streets, they also are trying to, the fashion persuasion method, and have designers do these incredible things, and women on the runway wearing niqab and all kinds of veiling that actually isn't even truly Iranian.
And it's pointed out that I think Iran has more cosmetic surgery, at least per capita, than any other country in the world,
yeah.
because in some cases that's the only part of your body that can be displayed. So
right.
people devote all their attention to
right.
elaborating on that one section.
Right, noses, nose jobs.
Nose jobs, right.
Right. Yes, and even people who don't, she points out that even people who don't have nose jobs or didn't get real ones will wear a Band-Aid.
Ah, so it'll seem that they did.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm going to throw out two more fascinating facts, and then I'd like to get to some actual, some of the real spiritual and political connotations. But as a social factor, it's pointed out one author towards the very beginning, I guess this is the very first essay, says, in the Arab world, it's becoming apparent that with every step toward democratization, women help vote in more Islamic candidates, not fewer, and with many a step toward liberalization in Arab societies, more, not fewer, women seem to be adopting the veil. And that it's something that the women, that is not being imposed upon women in this situation, when they have the opportunity to choose. Right now, many, many women are choosing veils, not just having them forced on them by the fashion
police.
Many
women are, you know, I mean, my cousins, and I have cousins in Egypt who are my age, and that is to say middle-aged, and they never veiled, and their daughters are beginning to veil. There's a wonderful book by one of our, it's an old book, it's from about 1992, by one of our contributors, Sharifa Zuhur, called Revealing Reveiling, which is about this phenomenon of people, of young women choosing now to veil, whereas they didn't before. Women my age simply didn't do it, you know, except in countries like, after 79 in Iran and in places like Saudi Arabia, but where it's, you know, never not been mandated, apparently, but as long as Saudi Arabia's been a country, anyway. And it is true, and some of that has to do with an idea of solidarity and resistance toward the aggression and colonialism. Some of it may be, just as in the United States, people are being drawn toward more fundamentalistic, I know it's not quite a word, but we'll use it anyway, ideas of religion and spiritual practice. And also religion everywhere, not just Islam, is becoming more political. But also, as we have young Muslim women becoming more attracted to the veil and going toward the veil, we also have, for example, young women religious, as they choose to become nuns, being much more drawn, once again, even after the battles of 1965 and the Vatican Council, once again, they're being much more drawn to the habit and the wimple and the more traditional denominations. It just seems to be a worldwide phenomenon. More women, I think probably there's a draw toward Orthodox Judaism that there wasn't necessarily before. It just seems to be happening everywhere.
And it happens in somewhat contradictory ways as well. Another author points out that Indians who settled in America tend to be far more conservative in their tastes and lifestyles than the jet setters of Delhi, Mumbai, and so on.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, just the other day I was at a panel in which people were talking about how there's probably more Zionism among American Jews than among Israeli Jews.
I can believe that.
Sure.
Except perhaps for some, maybe Israeli,
well,
Russian
yeah.
Jews or a few groups, but
sure.
in the country overall.
Right, right, as a sort of general thing.
Well, let's get back.
For one thing, Israelis, you know, are right there. They see what's going on, and they are just who they are.
Okay, I'd like to go. We've been tossing out all these general, or not these odd facts, and I'd like to get a little more systematic now. And
We've
been talking about veiling is basically covering parts of the body, especially the head and the hair, and seems to have, to some degree, been a sign of status and in some degrees a sign of modesty or submission to a particular religious belief or doctrine. Are there any societies? Well, I guess almost all societies have either veils, facial painting or scarification, tattooing and so on, or masks. How would you, is there any way to distinguish among these four ways of changing your body to express your belief or express your place in the universe?
Any way to distinguish? I'm not sure.
Well, you in particular, you make a big difference between veils and masks. The men tend to wear masks.
Actually, I try to point out the similarities in many ways between them. Although generally, anthropologists, I think, would say, and certainly, you know, experts in masking would say that it's much more of a masculine practice worldwide to mask than to veil. But in some very deep way, it's the same idea. They're both the same idea. They have to do with covering, with concealing, with meeting the divine in some form. But it isn't simply that we are changing our bodies, but we also veil or mask or hide the sacred objects and sacred places. There's something in the need to, in some way, conceal that which is sacred, or to hide from God, if it's God you believe in, or, you know, the divine. And it does seem to be a universal trait that people do this, that you, or you cover the divine, either as a notion of humility, or you could even be hiding from the divine.
So
it's not to be quite noticed.
Yeah, it does get very complicated.
It gets very complicated. A little hard to describe. I'm sorry, I'm not doing a better job here.
I guess when I said it is true that in your particular essay, when you're talking about the similarities between veiling and masking, you point to the Tuareg men of North Africa who veil almost all of their face, and whereas the women do not, and they consider it shameful to have their mouths exposed.
Mm-hmm.
But you also point out in that same essay that men who wear masks in combat tend to be more aggressive and more brutal than ones who don't.
Well, sure, because you're hidden, you're anonymous, right?
Right.
I mean, with anonymity, you can be anybody.
Right, and I thought that perhaps a mask as opposed to a veil could be a greater invitation to aggressiveness.
And some levels it is, and not just in the idea of combat. I also point out that, you know, those people who are less powerful, like the Intifada or the Basque, you know, the Basque fighters, guerrillas, are often, and in the Sandinistas wore masks too. What it can be is also it's a symbol outside to the person that you're fighting. It makes you look stronger than you may actually be because you're anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
The weaknesses aren't shown. But, and in a way, Matt. Oh?
Hello? Keep going.
Masking has a more aggressive quality in worship. To veil, you become, in many ways, more humble and pulled away, whereas masking can be a sort of shamanistic outward going into the cosmos. It's a way that you hide yourself in order to go forth into the power of the holy presence or whatever it is. So, I mean, there are those differences for sure, but there are also very many similarities.
And I guess, as you just pointed out, to sort of overcome all of my attempts to categorize things, that you can, veiling, part of the means of, or the meaning of veiling is hiding, but you can be hiding yourself from other people to commune with God, but you can be hiding from God, you can be hiding your interaction with God, you can be hiding many, many things.
Exactly.
You can also just be dignifying it to a certain degree by showing that you are willing to put on certain clothing to undertake a certain activity, and
that's
that
right.
means that it's got something special about it.
That's very well put, exactly.
One of the main features of veiling is sometimes hiding the face, but especially hiding the hair. And one thing that you mentioned several times, that different religious groups speak, and I think especially Islamic ones, speak of the sensuality of the hair, and if the men saw women's hair, they just couldn't control themselves.
But St. Paul said the same thing.
Right.
St. Paul in Corinthians.
Right.
He says it several times, but Corinthians is the big one where he actually orders women to veil. But he talks about, you know, the distractions of the hair. And I think it's true with Judaism, too. I mean, many, many, you know, Jewish women will shave their heads at marriage.
And then will wear a wig, which is perfectly all right.
Right, right. And as Michelle Auerbach points out in her piece, the woman, she talks about this woman, her babysitter, who then became Orthodox and wore a wig, and much to her mother's dismay, another example. And the wig looked better.
The other thing, though, that has always struck me that I didn't notice particularly drawn out in your essays, although in the essays, though, I may have missed it, is that hair is also a strong expression of personality. It's, aside from painting our faces or doing a few things like that, it's the easiest way to change our appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And so organizations that want people to give up their individuality or to become part of the mass require that they shave their hair or hide their hair. And this can either be monasteries, nunneries, or military organizations like the Army or the Marines.
Oh, sure, yeah, sure, sure. It can be any number of things. I mean, you know, I think in some of the fundamentalist Protestant Christian groups, there's a lot of hair covering as well. Hair is, you know, but men then grow a beard. What's that about?
Well, they can do it.
And they
they can change their faces in that way. Mm-hmm. They can change their faces mm-hmm. much more than any women can do. Are women ever envious of men for their beard ability?
Probably only when they start getting old, and the wrinkles come. Men can cover up their wrinkles more. I don't know.
Yeah, the sensual aspect then is emphasized if you can cover and uncover. And the very first essay in the second section on the sensuality of the veil is about the story, the myth, the legend, the various versions of the story of Salome. And it turns out that most of the really sensual aspects of that have only existed for maybe the last 100 years or less.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And in the original story, I guess in the Middle Ages, Salome was her dance was more acrobatic. She was depicted as walking on her hands.
Well, it's a legend. It's a myth that grows and grows. I mean, she starts out as a Jewish princess with an unnamed,
mm-hmm.
although you know, people have tracked down that her name was Salome, you know, through Josephus, who was the historian of the time, and knew that the stepdaughter of what's his name, Herod was named Salome, and so there is an actual, you know, sort of semi-history for a real Salome. But in that biblical story, she's unnamed, and it just grows and grows and grows and grows. You know, she's, and until, and it's actually never stopped. Everywhere you look, there's something to do with Salome. Just, you know, it's like mushroom hunting. First you don't see them, and then you see them everywhere. You know, just look everywhere, you'll see Salome, especially in Europe, especially in Paris. But so this, yeah, it becomes first a morality story. And as for her dancing, you know, the dancing, probably, my guess is that, like, it's fashionable, so that in the Middle Ages, when they depict her dancing and she's doing this acrobatic stuff, it's probably because that was the dancing of the time. Just like, you know, you see pictures of the birth of Christ, but Mary is wearing the same outfit that Guinevere might be wearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the costumes didn't change, dancing didn't change. It was just depicted as it was at the moment. But yeah, then it moves into Flaubert, and it becomes a literary thing. But at the same time, it seems to describe what Orientalists want to think of Middle Eastern women.
Right. It seems that actually in the middle of the 19th century, some people commented that Middle Eastern Christian women were dressed more modestly than Middle Eastern Muslim women. But the Muslim women, when they danced, they certainly did not wear the skimpy, what we think of as a belly dancing costume. That's purely a Western invention.
Oh, yeah, it is. And then it goes back to Egypt, where there's now a film industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Egyptian dancers, and they pick up this Hollywood outfit, or actually even pre-Hollywood, because you've got people like Maud Allen, who was, you know, a famous. She's pictured, I think, in the book,
right.
And she sort of invented. She actually, I think, sort of invented that belly dance costume as we know and love it today, although a little more modest.
Although she was, her act was called The Veils of Salome, I think,
right.
And it was based on the simple fact in Oscar Wilde's play, Salome, which then became Richard Strauss's opera. He simply says she dances the dance of seven veils,
right.
But it quickly became a sort of glorified striptease.
Right, exactly.
Which is something that had probably never existed in the Middle East.
Oh, absolutely not, unless behind closed private doors and... That's none of our business.
Yeah, but then Maud Allen carried this farther and turned it into what people came to think of as the Middle Eastern dance costume.
Right, exactly. And then you get, you know, also Little Egypt coming in there with the so-called Little Egypt at the World's Fair. But she's not wearing that costume, but she is doing a kind of an immodest dance, considered immodest. You know, by the lights of Victorian corseted ladies. It's really fascinating.
Right. And so it gets to be a matter of, well, putting on and taking off has a whole dimension that didn't exist there before.
That's right.
But it doesn't come from the veiling societies themselves. It comes from essentially Western entertainment and Western
mm-hmm.
consumerism.
Right, exactly.
And in terms of morality, there's one of the authors discusses totally covered, bored Saudi princesses who will take their drivers out into the desert completely clothed and everything just to pick up men. Whereas the women who probably are wearing Western costumes, Western clothing, are probably considerably more modest.
Probably, but you know... Let's just back up with that one with
okay.
The Saudi thing. The Saudi thing comes from, and it says so in the book, a film.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And it's supposedly a documentary, but there are people, Saudis, who say that what it depicts is not true. I don't know, you know. But we do make the caveat that it is in the film. And who knows, maybe it does happen. Strange things happen. People do very odd things, especially under the veil.
And there are, you hear about Middle Eastern women who among themselves, not knowing what they, when Western women visit them, among themselves are sort of glory in their clothing and in their sensuality in ways that they can't display on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there's a wonderful, in the art show that I created that goes with, that doesn't go with the book, but it's hand in glove with the book. One of the artists is Anita Kuntz, and this was the cover of The New Yorker. And it's marvelous because it shows sitting on a stoop, and I think Harlem behind her, there's a subway map. There's a woman in niqab, which is the Muslim veil that only shows the eyes, a nun, and a young woman wearing, you know, a tank top, or a little bra top, flip-flops, long blonde hair, all naked virtually except for, you know, shorts and this top, and big sunglasses.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, so here we are. That's what we're looking at these days, right? And what we're looking through. To me, it's very interesting that in fact, those sunglasses are that girl's veil.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely. So,
but at the same time, she's completely immodest, practically naked.
But nobody will know who she is.
Right.
Or she hopes.
She hopes, right? Exactly.
Tell us more about the exhibit that is, goes hand in glove with the book.
Oh, did you not know about this? The exhibit is called The Veil, Visible and Invisible Spaces. And I thought that as the... just as I wanted to hear about what women writers had to say about the veil and historians and scholars, I wanted to think about what visual artists would have to think about have to say about the veil. And so I put together this show. There are about 29 artists, really wonderful artists from all over India, there, you know, Iraq, Palestine, all kinds of, there's an Iranian woman with these tiny little, they're not tiny, they're 20 centimeter, but they're little, papier-mâché dolls called the women. They look like cocooned butterflies, and they hang on the wall, row after row after row of them. They're all made out of Iranian newspaper. They're papier-mâché. There are photographs and DVDs and little films and, you know, art films, that are just, it's all just really pretty marvelous. And it's a whole range, just like the book, of what the veil is. So it's hidden communities, it's hidden, but it's, you know, from the point of view of visual artists. So the writers got their say, and now the visual artists get theirs. And this show is traveling around the country for about 5 years. It's about to head out to Arkansas, to the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, and then it'll go to Milwaukee and all around the country.
Is it coming to the West Coast, or has it already been here?
It's going to be in the West Coast. No, it's really just starting.
Oh.
We just launched it in May, June here in Boulder, so we could look at it and, you know, fix it up and whatnot. And, yeah, it's going to be in Santa Clara, California, Santa Clara, the University of Santa Clara. It's going to be at CSU Dominguez Hills. I can't remember the years exactly. I think Dominguez Hills is 2010. Anyway, it goes on into 2013. It'll be all over the place.
Okay, well, University of California Press did not mention this anywhere in their...
That's because I didn't invent it until
after
the book was already out. So, but so it's all on the... It's all there. I put them all together on a website, so, you know, that's where they all are. But no, they didn't know. I didn't know. It just hit me that would be a cool idea.
So what's the website?
It's www.theveilbook.com. All one word, .com.
Okay, I got that. www.theveilbook.com.
Yeah. And you can see some of the artwork. and you can see, you know, information about the book. It's just all in there.
Okay, great. I wish I had known about that beforehand, but I will be there and probably by 2:30 this afternoon. To wrap all this up, the last section, we've jumped around in your book on the various topics. The last section, which is political, is almost entirely the Muslim world. Not completely, but whereas the other sections jumped all over the place, the last ones tend to be well about Purda and patriarchy and the tropical sun in India, but the rest all have to do with Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and so on.
No, and no, we talk about what else we can, but it, yeah, okay, I'm sorry.
But especially about that part of the world. And the thing that comes up again and again and again is how double-sided the whole question of veiling and unveiling is. Mm-hmm. That in the early 20th century, first Mustafa Kemal Atatürk required all women, Turkish women, to stop wearing the veil and did it in a rather brutal way. And even now, wearing headscarves is not allowed in Turkish universities, which is something that's a huge controversy there.
Well, it was, and now it's banned again.
Right.
It's very, yeah, I've just been reading a lot about that lately. I'm trying to think it out. And in fact, I read, and I couldn't tell you where because my eye went past it, and now I have to find it again. I read that one solution to this, is an interesting factoid, possible factoid, is that Turkish women who are devout and want to wear the veil may begin to wear wigs, like the Hasidic women.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
See how we're all linked?
Yeah. And that, again, in following, sort of copying Atatürk, the Shah of Iran, when he took power in the 20s, he started banning the veil, and again, forcing women, sometimes literally by force, to take them off.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time his son, the last Shah, the Islamic Revolution, as it was gathering steam, Iranian women started veiling themselves as a protest against his regime and his policies. But then after the Islamic Republic was established, many of these same women did not like the fact that they were being forced to reveil.
That's right. And had never veiled at all, probably.
Right, or may have done it just as a political protest, but then as soon as it was required, they realized that's not what they wanted.
Well, that's what people say, is that, and many Iranians say, is that they were fooled, in a sense, in that they put it on as a gesture of solidarity with the revolution against the Shah as a symbol, and then ended up having to wear it all the time. And that, I think, is part of one of the fears of women in Turkey today, is that, you know, I mean, it's very, very complex in Turkey, really quite complex, and lots of nuances and back and forth. But one thing is that people are afraid that if they begin to wear the veil, or if people are allowed to wear the veil in public places, the pressure will be on for everyone to wear the veil. You know, that it'll be sort of, this keeps happening in some way. In Aisha Shahid's piece about dress codes and modes,
mm-hmm.
I mean, she talks about this, and I think it's important to note this, that Islam, which is not a monoculture, but now there is this idea, you know, we speak of Muslim cultures. What's that?
And they go all the way from Senegal to Indonesia.
Exactly, exactly. So there's that. But then now we have this new Muslim dress. What's that? It's non-existent, really, except as it's being brought in. A Filipina might go to work in Saudi Arabia and come back wearing the abaya.
Because she had to wear it there, or because
she had to wear it there. And now it becomes just part of her sort of, you know, her life, her mode of being. There are ways in which for example, Wahhabists will find to force women or mm-hmm. intimidate women into wearing the veil. That is, I mean, they may already have been wearing their own kind of veil, but now it has to become this abaya or Saudi veil. I can't remember all that. I'm sorry to be so kind of vague about it, but in Aisha's piece, she talks about this kind of monoculturing of veiling, whereas once, you know, each place had its own tradition, its own way, or not. And I think that's a great fear in Turkey, and just as it sort of happened in Persia, in Iran.
And it's a big controversy in France now, too.
Yes, yes, and that controversy is actually, to me, a very French one, in that the French, since the revolution, have separated church and state and been very adamant about it. So that in France, there has also been, they also kicked a kid out of school for wearing a yarmulke. And somebody else was, suspended from her job until she took off the great big cross she was wearing. So while there is a focus, unfortunately, on Muslims throughout Europe, you know, with the colonialism having come home to roost, I fear. Nevertheless, I do. The French are quite egalitarian about this. They really don't like it, and they haven't since 1786 or whatever.
And some of the authors express their strong ambivalence about covering themselves. I'm thinking particularly of Pamela Taylor, who mm-hmm. who was a convert, and she wears the hijab, mm-hmm. the headscarf. I think as much as to demonstrate her faith and her solidarity, but she sometimes feels she should take it off because of all the implications it's come to have.
Oh yeah,
and then other times feels that she should keep it on because she'll be more accepted among Muslims and Muslim women if she keeps it on. But she's more dissed by when she speaks before non-Muslim groups.
Right, but if she keeps it on, also she has more authority. Even as she's being dissed, she still has more authority. I mean, I think she talks about that too in some way. She has authority as a Muslim woman. It's very confusing and very complicated, and I really love that piece for that very reason. And the fact that she carefully, in the end notes, talks about, sort of outlines what's in the Quran and what's not, and what's in the Hadith, which is the sayings of the Prophet, and what's not, and how, wearing this, she's still a feminist. Because that's, been a big problem with the West, is that we like to see all this among Muslims as somehow Muslim women being shrouded, ghostly creatures, terribly, always abused, inevitably abused, and relentlessly miserable, and, And, I mean, that's our problem. It isn't so. It really is not so. And, of course, the exploitation. Where's Mavis Leno? What are the names? Mavis Leno, when we need her. Now, when the Taliban is coming back to Afghanistan. But, oh, the fuss and carrying on about the poor Afghan woman. And the poor Afghan woman is starving to death. The Shadri is not the big problem. These things become these bugaboos for Western feminists, and it's a kind of colonialism that's also been exploited by the Bush administration to say, and Laura Bush has been quoted as saying that, we've liberated the women of Afghanistan. Oh yeah. and now, in Iraq, women who were unveiled, I mean, Saddam gave women, I think in the Constitution in something like 1980, women were equal. They could run for government, all of it. And now, since our invasion, I mean, I'm not speaking for Saddam, I'm just telling you the facts here. Since our invasion, women are running for cover, and they're veiled again. I mean, hello? What's going on here?
Now, I know from your your own essay in the anthology that you grew up with a diplomatic family, moved around the world a lot. You were in different cultures and so on. But I know nothing about your religious background, and you don't have to tell me. But I'm just curious, have you ever worn any sort of veil?
Well, gosh. When I go to Afghanistan, I do a lot of humanitarian work in Afghanistan. I always veil, but I don't wear a burqa. But I always wear a headscarf. And I will in other countries where I feel it's proper and necessary, either for my safety or out of sign of respect. It just depends on where I am. I travel as much as I can. I like to travel a lot and do research, and also I give a lot of talks and am invited here and there. So it all depends. My own religious upbringing is my mother was an Irish Catholic and my father was a Zen Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
And I really had no particular religious upbringing except that, you know, my mother was Catholic and every now and then she would sort of kick in and do that. So I suppose I veiled in the sense that when we went to Mass, I wore a little mantilla. But I didn't really have much of an upbringing. My parents were intellectuals and very, very liberal people.
As were the parents of several of the other authors who have since reverted to traditional religion.
Oh, sure. Oh, you're thinking of, for example, Eve Grubin, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think
two of the Jewish writers in particular grew up with secular parents, and then one. Let's see.
Yes, Michelle Auerbach, and she
right.
had that funny line about, you know, how her parents were cultural relativists, and what was the line about how, you know, in the tone of voice, she would say she was raised by wolves. But her mother had been the daughter of a rabbi or something.
Right, so it wasn't too far away.
So it just keeps moving, right? But I am not a particularly religious person. No, I haven't gone, you know, I'm a respectful person. I think whatever gets you through the night, it's all right. I have what I call the John Lennon theory of religion. And I don't tell people my own spiritual practices because I don't feel it's anybody's business. But I do feel that, you know, as long as you keep it out of me, you know, and out of politics and out of people's bedrooms and out of people's homes and, you know, mind your own business, do whatever you want. I have no, but you know.
I think I know. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking for the last 45 minutes with Jennifer Heath about her new book, The Veil, Women Writers on Its History, Lore, and Politics, which was recently published by University of California Press. And she also has this art show that she sprang on us after that. And I guess you can find out about the art show by going to theveilbook.com. And it's coming to several places in California, but not for several years. It's going to take its time getting its way. Was it heading from the Midwest east and then back west, or?
No, it's kind of running all around the country like a zigzag.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being with us. And
well, thank you very much.
I hope to be able to track down the show when it comes here. In the meantime, I'm going to go look up theveilbook.com myself and see what there is to see.
Thank you, and if you send me your address, I'll let you know about the show.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you so much, Eric.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I've only got a couple of minutes to go, and I wanted to mention the other book. I originally envisioned talking with the authors of two anthologies that the University of California Press has published in the last couple of months. The other one is called Servants of the Dynasty, Palace Women in World History, edited by Anne Rothall. And unfortunately, I only received this one last week, and I was unable to get in touch with the author to come on. In a way, that's all right, because the two books complement each other very well. And this one talks about how women exercised power quite often from behind the scenes, which could be, in a sense, from veiling, being veiled, or being in a harem, which is actually a sacred space in Middle Eastern societies. It is not a place for concubines, but it's a sacred place set off from the rest of the palace or from the rest of the community. Anyway, there's a lot in the book, Servants of the Dynasty, that complements the essays that were in The Veil. They are, however, much more academic and much drier. Most of the authors in The Veil are speaking of their personal experience or experience of family members or things they know about quite well. I would recommend Servants of the Dynasty as well, but only for people who like reading academic historical essays. But it starts with Southeast Asia, goes into the classic Mayan court, Byzantine, Ottoman, Mughal India, African harem, Qing China, Russia of Ivan the Terrible, and women of Versailles, colonial Mexico. It goes northern Nigeria in the 16th to 19th century. So it goes all over the place, and there's a lot of interesting material, but you have to be more of that mindset for that sort of stuff. Anyway, this has been Book Town, as I've said for again and again and again, KVMR FM in Nevada City. It's almost 2 p.m., and Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party is coming up. Thank you.